This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana on 89.3 WRKF. And coming later, we will visit with Barry Irwin, president of the Council for a Better Louisiana. We start with Davis Sobel. She is one of the most prominent, critically acclaimed, best-selling narrative nonfiction writers working today. Former science reporter for the New York Times, frequently featured on National Public Radio, and her latest book is The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. Previously, Deva wrote the well-received bestseller Longitude. And good morning to you, Deva Sobel.
Good morning, Jim.
It's nice to hear your voice joining us from Long Island. Your book opens in 1882 at a New York dinner party. That's kind of an unusual start to a book about science. But what happened?
There was a reception for the members of the National Academy of Sciences given by a member, Henry Draper, and his wife, Anna Palmer Draper. And they had about 40 people to dinner, including Thomas Edison.
Not your usual dinner guest. And something profound happened. What occurred?
Well, the guests were struck by the electric light available indoors, which was quite a novelty. And unfortunately, the host was not well that evening and died within days of the dinner party. And that set in motion a series of events. He and his wife had been working together on an exciting new project that involved photographing the stars. Photography was a new gimmick in astronomy. And they had a really brilliant idea, which they could not carry out. And the widow, Anna Draper, was wealthy enough and involved enough in the project to think she could carry on by herself. But it was too difficult for her. And so she turned to one of the guests at that dinner party, Edward Pickering, who was the director of the Harvard Observatory, and she asked him to take up the work and do it in her husband's name, and that she would provide the funding, something she did for 30 years. And that enabled Pickering not only to do this unusual work and make a success of it, but to hire many, many women to come in and perform the work.
This is the Harvard College Observatory, which began employing a few women as calculators, human computers, to interpret the observations their male counterparts made by a telescope each night. And it all started with a dinner party.
Well, after the dinner party and this other project started, then the women changed from being calculators or human computers to making discoveries from these detailed photographs of the night sky. And they really became astronomers. So they went on to be members of the professional society, to publish papers, attend scientific meetings in the United States and Europe, and to really become well-known internationally during their own lifetimes, which is not something, it's a story most people don't know and find extremely surprising, that such a happy situation prevailed in the late 1800s, early 1900s.
They made some extraordinary discoveries, attracting worldwide acclaim. What were some of the discoveries?
The constitution of the stars, the whole idea we have now that stars consist mostly of hydrogen, that came directly out of the women's work, and was questioned at first because it was so counter to expectations, but proved to be true. One of them discovered a way to measure distance in space, which is still used today. Her discovery led to an understanding of the size of our Milky Way galaxy, the distance to other galaxies, and the fact that space is
877-217-5757 if you'd like to talk with Davis Sobel in our time with her. Her book is The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars, named one of the best books of the year by Science Friday from NPR. And it is a remarkable story, and it is somewhat remarkable to listen to you talk about this dinner party, Deva, in 1882, in which people were, they were fascinated with light. And here we are, what, just 135 years later, and the things that we take for granted, how the world has changed.
How the world has changed. And but it's interesting to me to see how new scientific projects really pick up some of the same themes. We are still trying to study the whole sky. This group wasn't content with photographing from Cambridge. They set up a station in the southern hemisphere as well so they could incorporate the stars of the southern hemisphere, and brought in different kinds of instruments to study the brightness of the stars, the chemical composition. They also created a classification system to distinguish the different types of stars, and that is still in use today as well.
These are some amazing women that you portray and profile. Anna Palmer Draper is one of them. Tell us about her.
She was the hostess of the dinner party and had been her husband's partner in all his astronomical work. They were a close pair. And at his sudden early death at age 45, she really wanted to continue but was unable to carry on by herself and turned the work over to one of the guests at that dinner party, Edward Pickering, director of the Harvard Observatory. And with his willingness and her money, they created a project that went on for the rest of her life, another 30 years, and on beyond that. And the 500,000 glass photographs that were taken are remain a valuable resource.
There is Wilhelmina Fleming. She had an unusual start, but certainly was a big part of this process.
Yeah, she came to work at the observatory as a maid, a domestic servant, because she was a young Scottish immigrant who had arrived here as a bride, but soon found herself alone and pregnant. And in that desperate situation, she took the maid's job, but Director Pickering recognized how intelligent she was and moved her right into the observatory, taught her how to do computation and how to look at the plates for analysis of different star features. And then he helped her go home to Scotland to have her baby in the company of her mother and grandmother. She was so grateful, she named the baby after him, and she came back 2 years later and resumed her work. She eventually brought her son over and managed to put him through MIT as a working mother before the concept even existed. And then she became the first woman to hold a Harvard University title. She was the curator of astronomical photographs.
You have
a
chapter, Deva, called Miss Cannon's Prize, and this refers to Annie Jump Cannon. She was a Wellesley College graduate, and she is a big part of this book as well.
Yes, she was the one who created the classification system that is still in use today, and she was a widely known and loved character because of her work. People got to know who she was, and then people who met her just always found her personal warmth so engaging. They would keep up a friendship with her that continued through correspondence, and she would also write to her colleagues' children and encourage them in whatever work they did. It was remarkable reading her diaries and letters to see how much she was able to accomplish.
Now, you have, as I noted, wrote Longitude and Galileo's Daughter, which was nominated for the 2000 Pulitzer Prize. Are you heartened by the reception that you have received for this book, Dave?
I am. The reviews have been wonderful. That's been very exciting, and it's nice to get to be on a program like yours and talk to you about it, too.
Well, we'll talk for a few more minutes, and if you'd like to join the conversation, 877-217-5757. You can send us an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. Barry Irwin from Cable is next as well. Stay tuned. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Emily Gunn is producing today. You're listening to Talk Louisiana on 89.3 WRKF, and we're visiting for a few more minutes with Dava Sobel. She is a remarkable writer about science, has done this for a while, and her latest work has been very well received, named one of the best books of the year by NPR, The Economist, Smithsonian, and Nature. It is The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. Why did it take so long to tell their story, Dava?
That's a good question. I was thrilled to find that no one had told the whole story. I think part of the reason is the number of people involved, that it wasn't immediately obvious how to tell the story, whether to choose one person and just focus on one woman's contribution, or really look at the group as a whole and the friendships, the interactions. At the beginning, these women were really married to their work. If one of them got married, she left. Mrs. Fleming had been married before she came and then stayed on. But later, by the 1930s, there was a different attitude in the country and in the observatory community. Especially by that time, there were female graduate students. A graduate program in astronomy was created thanks to the influx of money from women supporters. And since the money was specifically earmarked for women, all of the first graduate students came from the women's colleges. And within a few years, money was provided to bring in men, too. And then there were a couple of romances at the observatory. And marriage was okay. One astronomer could marry another one.
Well, how challenging was it to go back to 1882 to that dinner party and find out what happened?
1882 is not nearly as long ago as the other stories I've written. So I actually found almost the opposite problem, in that there was so much information. That party was something Mrs. Draper remembered all her life and spoke about it to Miss Cannon at the observatory, and it was even mentioned in Mrs. Draper's obituary.
And you have other documents.
Letters, diaries.
Memoirs. Yeah.
Yes.
It's all in vivid detail in The Glass Universe, the hidden story of a group of remarkable women whose astronomical breakthroughs forever changed our understanding of the stars and our place in the universe. And it's called The Glass Universe, and we thank you for joining us today. It's been a pleasure talking with you, Dava Sobel.
Thank you very much.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're joined now by Barry Irwin, the president of the Council for a Better Louisiana. He's been with Cable for 22 years. And Barry Irwin, good morning to you.
Good morning.
It's nice to see you. And yesterday, the governor of Louisiana went to New Orleans and made a big announcement at the Mercedes-Benz Superdome, coming nearly a decade after state and local officials began trying to position Louisiana and New Orleans as a fledgling technology hub. What happened yesterday?
Well, it was a pretty big announcement. A company called, I think it's DXC, which doesn't mean a lot to a lot of people, as much many of these technology companies, the names don't always mean a lot, but it is kind of a spinoff of Hewlett-Packard, announced that they were going to be locating a technology center there, and ultimately over the next several years hiring 2,000 people, which is a pretty big deal.
Yeah, 2,000 workers in New Orleans, and of course the spinoff activity could be more than that. So this is a win for the Edwards administration, and we saw in the previous administration Bobby Jindal had some success, but the state certainly greased the skids to make a lot of businesses come here.
Always. I mean, we do have a lot of incentive programs. Some of them have specifically been targeting these type of innovation companies, digital technology companies. And I think that's a good thing. I mean, if we're going to be playing in the field of competing for different industries and things like that, we certainly need to be able to be a player in the digital sector. And again, some of the LED programs specifically target these types of companies, which do help diversify our economy. And they do pay off, but they do come at a cost as well to taxpayers.
Well, yeah, it's a company valued at $25 billion. It's the 110th largest company in the world with 170,000 global employees. So it's good that this company is coming our way. But there were probably some incentives. I think there has been an estimate on this of $44 million. That's a lot of money, but not as nearly as much as it took to bring IBM to Baton Rouge.
Well, and, you know, actually, I think when you add it all up, it probably comes to even more than that over a period of time. I mean, I think, you know, to play in this kind of arena, you have to do these types of things. I mean, look what Amazon's doing across the country with their leveraging of communities. Who knows what that's going to cost? This isn't Amazon by any stretch. But I think one of the encouraging things about it is that the incentives include a pretty good shot in the arm to higher education. Particularly in the computer science area and that type of thing. And given all of the cuts that we've had in higher ed over the years that everybody knows about, the fact that at least some of these departments, which are really part of the future for our economy, are getting a boost over a period of time of that kind of money, I think really is a good investment for our state.
877-217-5757. Locally, you can dial 297-5633 in Baton Rouge for Barry Irwin, president of Cable. He's been with the Council for Better Louisiana for 22 years, and Barry was a television reporter prior to that for 15 years, including about a decade at WBRZ Channel 2. So he's been both a media person and a watchdog, and you've gotten very accustomed to this. But right now, the state is facing this so-called fiscal cliff that if something is not done, Barry, we're just 7.5 months away, and this truly, if something is not done, is the calm before the storm.
Well, absolutely is. And, I mean, this clock has been ticking for some period of time, as you know. It just continues to tick. I mean, theoretically, last legislative session was theoretically the year that we were going to make the permanent fix and do some things to our tax structure to improve it, make it more competitive, and actually make kind of our future more sustainable. Of course, we didn't do that. We punted the thing down the road. We passed some temporary sales taxes in 2016. Those are still on the books, but they will be gone in 2018. And it totals more than $1 billion. And, you know, there's that clock is ticking. On the encouraging side, I do think that there are some conversations going on now with legislators and the administration that perhaps we didn't see earlier on, and I guess you could say maybe I'm cautiously optimistic that we may see something happen before the regular session begins next year, but we shall see.
Well, if something isn't done, the general fund is not the $30 billion that we hear for the overall budget. It's about $9 billion. If you lose $1 billion of the $9 billion, it's a world of hurt.
Sure, and then when you add up all the things that, as we know, are dedicated constitutionally and otherwise, the biggest part being the $3 billion plus to public education, which is really hard to cut any of that because of the way it's constitutionally dedicated. And then you throw in the mandatory payments for even participating in the Medicaid program, which approaches another $1 billion. You add all that up, and then the cutting part is even less than that. I mean, it would truly be devastating. And for those that say, well, we can cut our way out of it, I mean, with all due respect, that this is just too big of a cut to make.
Well, it only takes 30 one votes, well, I guess 36 votes, 70, it takes 70 to pass. That's the real number we're looking at, two-thirds of the 105 members of the House. And that seems to be a daunting challenge. For example, last year there was talk that 64 members were aboard for a gasoline tax. But we didn't get it. And is 70 votes palatable in this day and time?
Well, I think it's going to have to be. And I think the thing to remember, too, is, I mean, we're facing a fiscal cliff, but we're not necessarily talking about raising more taxes for the state. We've already raised those taxes. We're paying them right now. The fact is, though, they're just going to go away. So really what we're talking about is either to continue those sales taxes, which I think our group and others would say are not the best for tax policy, or to try and do something a little bit different.
877-217-5757 for Barry Irwin of Cable. Now the news with Karen Henderson. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us, and we'd like to hear from you. 877-217-5757 or 297-5633, or send us an email at talk@talklouisiana.org. Emily Gunn is producing today, and Barry Irwin is in the house, the president of the Council for a Better Louisiana, one of the primary watchdog groups in Louisiana. Dan downtown. Good morning, Dan. You're on the air with Barry.
Yes. Is there an analogy to be drawn between Cameron Henry and the right-wingers in the state legislature and the Republicans in Congress that have to make sure their campaign donors get a big tax cut, regardless of what it does to the deficit and the availability of decent education and health care for average families?
Well, I think... not to get into personalities, but I do think when you look at our legislature, particularly in the House where you're talking about, you see sort of the same dynamic now that you see in Congress, where you've got kind of a very fiscally conservative, very, very conservative faction that has a lot of sway within the House right now. But also within the Republican Party in the House, you have a more moderate group, which I guess you could kind of use the analogy to be more like traditional Republicans on the fiscal issues, but also on trade and those types of issues like that. And then you've got the Democrats. So you've got sort of the same dynamic between the two parties and then breaks within the two parties. And that's been, I think, part of the challenge, because I think, you know, in our state legislature at least, you can't just lump Republicans as all into the same category. There are different variations of them, and they kind of have different views about how we should be proceeding on this. And I think, at least on the encouraging side, and I say encouraging because we need to have a permanent solution to this problem, and I think there's some folks that want to do that, you're seeing those folks meeting now privately, but getting together and going across the aisle with the Democrats as well, trying to craft some kind of solution that's not going to be some big tax and spend type of thing, I don't believe, or certainly hope not, but one that would be something more sustainable and competitive for the future. So that's why I'm somewhat optimistic.
877-217-5757 for Barry Irwin of Cable, Steve in St. Francisville. Steve, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana. I think this is our former budget director, Steve Wynnum. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, hey, Jim. Hey, Barry.
Hey, Steve.
I think that one of the biggest mistakes that we make, and we do it perpetually, is that we offer complicated solutions that require a bunch of little battles. We start losing those battles, and then we ultimately lose the war on balancing our budget. And I think that you can go all the way to the very simplest thing, which would be to eliminate the deductibility of federal income taxes from both individual and corporate income taxes in Louisiana, and you'd have $1 billion right there. And then you could either cut and or not fund the difference, and the problem would be solved. There are slightly more complicated solutions, but I just think that we always go too far.
Well, look, I think you're right about that. In fact, you know, the task force that we served on and others did as well in 2016, that was kind of the heart of our recommendation. That federal income tax deductibility is one that we're used to and is common here, but it's not common across the country. And in fact, we're one of only a very small handful of states that even have that. I think the issue now is that makes it more difficult is that is a constitutional change that needs to be made. And I think there's a sense that we're running out of time and the legislature doesn't have the appetite for something constitutional. constitutional after some of the things that have happened more recently in some of the elections on constitutional amendments. But, I mean, I think that is certainly one way to do it and one that we recommended as our top choice. I'm afraid we're probably going to have to go with more of a statutory approach that the legislature can do itself politically. But I think you're absolutely right. That's certainly one that we could solve the problem very quickly. You know, I will say this, too. I mean, Stelly, for the longest time, used to be about the worst word you could use in Louisiana talking about tax policy. But I sense something a little different now. And in fact, I mean, I'm thinking that part of the solution that we're going to see is something like a return to the Stelly type of approach.
But and that word will never be used, of course.
No, it won't.
It'll be the Irwin plan.
No, it won't be that either. But you know, we need to lower that sales tax and make that more manageable. I mean, that highest rate in the country just about is not really palatable, and we need to kind of get a better balance than we have.
Thank you, Steve. Good to hear from you. Yeah. Steve Winham, 877-217-5757. And the listener notes about the Stelly plan. That was a constitutional change, and think of all the heavy lifting that was involved in getting that passed, and it was doing the job. And then it was repealed by the legislature 9 years ago. Are a lot of the problems we have today related to that?
I think absolutely. I mean, the truth is we've been through all the things as we know about with the national recession, the oil and gas prices and all of that. But at the end of the day, the structural gap we have is pretty close to what we would be with if we'd had the Stelly still in place. We're talking about the Stelly today in today's dollars, $800, maybe close to $900 million. That's basically what we're talking about with this structural deficit that we have.
And think about our universities over the last decade. Healthcare, how it could have been improved with a few more dollars.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I don't know that people really understand the toll that these cuts have had on higher education over these last several years. We know it's impacted tuition. We know it's threatened TOPS, but the infrastructure, and I'm not just talking about physical infrastructure, but also the intellectual infrastructure within our universities has suffered as a result of this. And at some point, we do need to begin to build that back.
All right. Well, this is an issue that has a component as far as elections, and there's an election, actually the next gubernatorial election, the runoff will be 2 years and 2 days from now. Are lawmakers going to have one eye on the ballot box? And of course, Republicans, who have the majority in the House and Senate, probably would rather have one of their own as governor. Do they want to do anything to help the cause of the current governor?
Well, I think it's a mixed bag. I mean, I think there are some, and I include the Republican, you know, members of the Republican Party in this, that want to get this problem solved and be done with it. Some of them are just tired of this. I mean, some of these people have had to deal with this every single year since they've been in office, and they're tired of it. There are others that would like to kind of push it down the road and let, you know, a Republican governor, is what their hope would be, to come in and solve the problem that way. You know, politically, I still wonder about that strategy, because if I was going to run for governor, I would sure like to have that problem behind me as opposed to having to come in and raise the taxes and do whatever you'd have to do. But, you know, that's politics.
You can send us an email to talk@talklouisiana.org, and a listener notes that the candidate raising money right now for governor, a race for governor, is John Kennedy, the U.S. Senator, and he is one of those who is steadfast in saying that we can resolve our budget woes by ridding ourselves of these consulting contracts. Barry, is it that simple?
With all due respect, it's really not that simple, and it's not just consulting contracts. He kind of calls them consulting contracts, but he's talking about contracts in general, and I think what he doesn't realize is, you know, a lot of the services that are provided to people across our state in a variety of venues are provided through contracts. And I'm talking about things with health care, you know, services for people with disabilities, people with elderly. You know, those are contracts, too. So just getting rid of those contracts doesn't solve your problem. It just creates another one.
877-217-5757. Governor John Bel Edwards was in the legislature. Two terms, and he came in with 61 others, I think, in the House, and many of them are still there. And yet, I don't think he envisioned the challenges he's had dealing with the chamber where he served for two terms.
Now, it's been very difficult, and sometimes, you reap what you sow. I mean, he was sort of the loyal voice of the opposition while he was in there, and he put up roadblocks to a lot of the things that some of the leadership on the Republican side wanted to do. And so, now it becomes sort of tit for tat when you when you get into the governor's office, and he's certainly had to experience some degree of that.
Yeah, and it's a case in which politics can be mean, and some believe that he suffered a crushing defeat, maybe not a critical or a death knell defeat, but when he lost the race for speaker, before he even took the oath of office, his candidate, Walt Leger, was narrowly defeated.
And certainly there have been repercussions because of that throughout, the 2 years of his term. It was very close. I mean, in some ways, it's kind of remarkable that it was as close as it actually was.
And it was
when you
close.
Look at the makeup party-wise.
It wouldn't
the
be
House.
That close today.
No, that's exactly right.
No, it would not. And the battle lines are drawn. We definitely have some partisan lines that are not to be crossed. And the Republicans, from the GOP standpoint, they have every statewide office except the governorship, and they feel like it's within reach. And if this governor succeeds, and believe me, if he's able to get past this fiscal cliff, that'll be a success. Does it mean that he's headed for reelection?
I think it's always tough to say. And to be honest with you, part of solving this fiscal cliff on a permanent basis could have political ramifications that are negative for the governor. I mean, quite frankly, we might be putting ourselves in a better fiscal posture. And I'm not talking about raising more taxes. I'm just talking about restructuring the taxes that we have. But if you deal with, income taxes, different kinds of things that people can use against you, you just never know. You know how these campaigns go, and you've heard the TV commercials. I can hear them now. But it could be difficult. The other question, though, is, who really wants to step up and run on the Republican side? Does John Kennedy really want to run and leave the Senate, have to deal with a fiscal problem coming in? I don't know. It's a rhetorical question.
Louisiana boys, and even though he was born in Centerville, Mississippi, he's a Louisiana boy. They want to be governor,
Barrett.
Louisiana is much different than other states.
Yeah.
U.S. Senate seat in most places with a six-year term, and the bright lights of the Beltway, Potomac fever, that generally senators like what they have and would never dare run for governor of their state. Louisiana, a much, much different story.
It certainly is.
877-217-5757 is your number. We'll be back after this brief pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Emily Gunn is producing, and our guest for our final segment is Barry Irwin, president of the Council for a Better Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Barry, there's an election this Saturday, a statewide election, and if we're really fortunate, 15% of the people will show up. That's not good.
It's sort of mind-boggling, really. The truth is, I don't see TV all that much, but there's not even any advertising to go with that treasurer's race, a statewide race that to amount to much of anything. I mean, it really is a sad commentary. I heard Tom Shetler the other day at a ceremony. It was a Veterans Day ceremony, but he was talking about that very fact. And, one of the consequences of that is when you have such a small turnout, the percentage of people who are actually making the decision, the number of voters who are making the decision of who is going to be elected to a statewide office becomes rather minuscule in the scheme of things. And it's just not something you would think you would see.
Yeah, well, we have 4.7 million people, and Tom Shedler says if we're fortunate, we'll have 350,000 show up Saturday, and that means 175,000 votes can win a statewide office in a state with 4.7 million people. That's not good.
And then the difference between the two candidates becomes very marginal in terms of the number of voters that make the difference.
And New Orleans has the mayor's race, which means that there will be a larger turnout in Orleans Parish relative to the rest of the state. It could be as many as one-third of the votes cast coming out of Orleans, which gives Derek Edwards a fighting chance. Still a long shot, but a fighting chance of winning that race, and that would be an amazing upset if it were to occur. But John Schroeder He is the favorite in the treasurer's race. And that position is one that is significant. It's significant because the treasurer is, of course, the person who runs a bond commission, has a lot of say in fiscal matters in the state. But also, it's been used as a springboard by Mary Landrieu and by John Kennedy. I would imagine if Schroeder wins, probably at some point he'll be looking down the line as well.
It does make you think that way, doesn't it? But you're absolutely right. Both of them used it to their advantage to kind of raise the profile of themselves vis-a-vis the office itself, which is kind of a functional job in a lot of ways. But certainly John Kennedy raised the profile of the office and himself to a great degree over a number of years.
And I remember when John Kennedy won, his issue, he unseated Ken Duncan, was that Ken Duncan had paid for a private bathroom. That was the big issue in the treasurer's race. This time around, we have him talking about raising and lowering taxes, things the treasurer has nothing to do with, but it sounds good.
Right, and that's kind of, I think, the way that the position has been elevated to this kind of bully pulpit that it didn't really have, certainly in the old days of that position. But you can take a job like that and go a long way with it.
Barry Irwin is with us. Still time to get in under the wire, 877-217-5757. He was born in Alexandria, grew up in Shreveport, came to Baton Rouge 32 years ago, worked 10 years at WBRZ, and graduated from Louisiana Tech, graduate in journalism appropriately. And I thought of you on the day of June 3rd of this year. It was the 30-year anniversary of the disappearance of one Butch Baum.
Ah, yes. Candidate for governor.
That's right. He got on a plane and headed to Alexandria from Baton Rouge and
ended up in Oklahoma.
Shattuck, Oklahoma.
Yeah, it was obviously a tragic thing. He was a very well-known business insurance executive here in Baton Rouge. You know, I remember I was at Channel 2, and when word came that the plane was missing, John Spain, my boss, said, get in the car and drive north.
That's why I thought of you. You chased the plane.
We did until we got to that field, and it was a very tragic thing, obviously. But.
And if I remember correctly, you actually checked into a hotel briefly.
Very briefly.
In Shreveport.
In Shreveport with a photographer with video equipment. We were in the hotel room for just an hour or so and called up that video equipment, hauled it back out. It looked
Somewhat suspicious. But you made it to Shattuck, Oklahoma. And 30 years is a long time, but I don't think there was one story about the death of Butch Baum. And he was a guy who apparently had the money to launch a viable campaign. He would have been another heavyweight in a race full of heavyweights. I don't know if we'll ever see another race like that, Barry. We had Buddy Romer and Edwin Edwards and Bob Livingston and Billy Tozan and Jim Brown.
Yeah, I mean, Romer was probably the least known name of the bunch in a lot of ways and ended up winning, of course. But it was remarkable to have those folks with that visibility and all the name recognition all vying, you know, for the job. But it was certainly a historic election.
And Romer never won another race.
Right.
That was it. He won in 87. He was a 43-year-old governor, and then he never won again. And then he ran for re-election in 1991 and got squeezed by Edwin Edwards and David Duke. And come Thursday, we'll be 26 years removed from that race.
Yeah, I mean, Buddy Romer, you know, in a lot of ways, I think has been undersung, or maybe he's gotten his due more lately. But, I mean, people forget what he inherited when he became governor was every bit as bad as anything that we've had going on here, and perhaps probably worse, because not only did we have a budget shortfall, we had a budget deficit, and there's a difference there, and a deficit is worse. And he got us out of that situation, but it comes at a political cost.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and he certainly suffered the consequences. And of course, there were a lot of politicians that wanted him out for a lot of other reasons as well. So it was an interesting 4 years for sure.
And he had a fiscal reform plan that he got on the ballot.
Yep.
It would have raised taxes, and one of the architects was none other than John Kennedy, the same John Kennedy who now is against any tax, but he was the architect of this plan, along with others, like our friend Steve Wynham, who just called
right.
in. But people thought it was a good plan. April 30th, 1989, I remember it well, 55% of the people voted against it. There was a big push to vote against it, and I think that push was directed at the next election. They were trying to knock off Buddy Romer.
Obviously, I mean, I certainly think there was. Actually, you had a lot of the business community that was actually behind yes. it, too. I mean, they were, the leadership of the business community was pushing it. If we had done that, I mean, some things definitely would have changed, but it definitely would have put us on a much stronger fiscal posture for a long time. I mean, even though Romer got us out of the bind that he inherited, we got stuck with temporary taxes and a lot of the politics that went around that haunted us for years. I mean, it took Mike Foster to kind of come in and do the Stelly thing, which put us back on a more stable course. But here we are again, kind of, you know, reliving history, which I guess we are wont to do.
Well, it seems like we have the same old issues. And Barry, when Hurricane Harvey hit Houston, it was a time to reflect on Houston, who in 1950, New Orleans had more people than Houston.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It is, and now New Orleans is the third largest city in the state, the third largest parish, Orleans Parish, which is the city of New Orleans, and in Houston is the fourth largest city in America.
Well, I mean, the growth of Houston is to a large degree a story of the loss of everything in New Orleans. I mean, not the Katrina-related, of course, but that had started sooner or before that with the oil and gas people moving over there. I mean, you saw the same thing in Shreveport decades earlier, where there was a time when Shreveport and Dallas were not so far off in population, but you see what happened there too.
Right, but with 4.7 million people, we have fewer people than does the city of Houston or the city of Dallas. The metro areas are bigger by good margins than the whole state of Louisiana. And we've seen our congressional delegation get neutered to a large extent. Bill Cassidy is our senior senator. He's been there a few years. He won in 2014.
Yeah, 3 years.
And then our senior House member is Steve Scalise, and he succeeded Bobby Jindal.
Right.
So less than a decade ago. In the old days, as you know, we had people there 30, 40 years.
Oh, I found some photos from a project I was working on with LPB a number of years ago on a history project, and it showed all these members of our congressional delegation from the 60s and even early 70s. I mean, there were some heavy hitters there, and there was long seniority. We haven't seen anything like that for quite a long time.
And it makes a difference.
It definitely does. Yeah. Certainly in a state like ours, it's small, has great need. Arguably, with our coastal issues and whatever, some more clout could make a big difference for us.
The state of Alabama is getting a lot of attention these days. They have a good football team over there, but have a couple of good football teams, one of which lost to LSU. But this stuff with Roy Moore is going to be fascinating. And Bill Cassidy has come out full force against Roy Moore. John Kennedy is waiting to see.
It really is amazing. You know, it shows you how in this age things can turn on a dime, and that turned almost immediately. But it's a tough issue for a lot of the Republicans for political reasons, a variety of things. I'm sure they'd be just glad to get this out of the way as much as they possibly can.
But this is an unusual election because now there are people who are against Roy Moore who say, go ahead, elect him. And then we'll unseat him, and a Republican will retain the seat, where if he were to leave, it would probably mean a victory for the Democrat because it would be a write-in candidate going against him.
Yeah, and it just shows how the politics are, at the end of the day, the only thing that really matters when you're talking about the D.C. stuff. And I think that's kind of a shame, but that's where we are right now.
Well, you covered it on one side, and now you're experiencing it on another. And our people in Louisiana certainly have gotten used to political interaction that sometimes is not so pleasant. But, Barry, it's always good to get your take on the world. Good to see you again.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
And we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Until then, for Emily Gunn, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.